Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We always get a lot of questions about pruning, so today we have one of our experts back to help you out with that and a whole lot more, Laura Jull, with us. She's an associate professor and extension specialist in the UW College of Ag and Life Sciences, an expert on woody ornamentals, on nursery management, landscape installation, and maintenance and tree care. So, you're wondering if you can prune now, or maybe you're wondering when there's some still things you might be able to plant? What other woody ornamental, woody or other ornamental plant questions do you have? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Laura Jull, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Here we are, Halloween, and wanted to talk a little about spooky plants. And, you know, the one that comes to mind right away for me is the corpse flower, Titan arum.
Yeah, the corpse flower as it opens. And it doesn't flower very often. It's a greenhouse conservatory plant. And you don't want it in your house because it smells like rotting flesh as the flower opens, and it releases a very potent smell. And then the flower eventually closes back up, and it dies back.
Yeah, it takes about 7 years.
Yeah, 7 to 9 years.
For it to bloom.
To get it to flower. Mm-hmm. Long time.
Well, what else have you got? Have you got some other ones that we might talk about, some spooky plants for Halloween and beyond?
Yeah. Well, I've got a list that I gave you guys. I don't know if you can get that up on your website or...
We can get that up on our website for sure.
Okay. That'd be great. It's just like about 16 plants or so. But one that I found very macabre was serviceberry. Or Amelanchier.
Yeah.
It's our native serviceberry. It's also called shadblow. And that plant, when I learned it years and years ago, I was told that it's called serviceberry because the flowers bloom in early spring, very early spring. It's one of the first things to flower, and it's white flowers, real pretty. And they named it serviceberry because in the early days of the settlers, anybody that died over winter, they would put in a separate building or structure because they couldn't bury them because the ground was frozen. So when the serviceberry was in flower, they realized, hey, that's the time of year I can then get in the ground and plant the deceased. And therefore, serviceberry was its name.
I didn't know that. That's a cool story.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some really cool stories of a number of plants.
There's one that since it's a woody species, and I haven't seen your list, but Aurelia spinosa, devil's walking stick.
Yes. Devil's walking stick. That is a suckering shrub. It's not native here. It's native farther south of here, but it's a very aggressive plant. It sends up root suckers, but it is one that is covered, literally, the stems, the backside of the leaves, the stalks of the leaf are covered in spines, and it looks very menacing. The fruit is mildly poisonous. It's not real bad, but it's those sharp spines all down the stems that make it wicked looking.
Have you got another one or two you can give us, and then we'll move on.
Okay, another one. This is a wonderful herbaceous plant. It's called sanguinaria, or bloodroot. And bloodroot gets its name because the roots and the rhizomes contain this sap that is blood red, and it is poisonous. And if you get some on your skin and don't wash it off, it can cause, rarely, but it can cause dead skin flesh.
Yuck.
Yeah, there's so many cool ones. I mean, there's our Venus flytrap that is not hardy here. It's more of a conservatory plant. It's a carnivorous plant, and I love watching it snap its leaf shut, trapping insects. I know I need to get out more, but I think it's really a cool-looking thing when it traps flies, and they can't get out, and then they're trapped. And on the inside of the leaves, it has a substance that slowly digests the insect.
Yeah. That one, you can buy Venus fly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're,
oh, yeah.
I know in North Carolina, the population dropped so much that they had, because of illegal removal for the plant trade.
Right. Yeah. I've seen them in North Carolina in the woods. It's a very small population, but yeah, a very cool plant. And don't take plants in the wild. You don't want to deplete ours. And can I mention just one more?
Sure. Go ahead.
Oh, this one's really gross. It's called, the scientific name is called Ilex, which is a holly, vomitoria. And it's called Yaupon holly. And Yaupon holly gets the Native Americans and the early settlers used to use the leaves and fruit and other herbs into a tea that would cause them to vomit. It's part of a ritual, spiritual cleansing thing. However, I'd like to note that Yaupon holly, the leaves actually contain a good amount of caffeine, and it can be made into a tea without vomiting. But I imagine they used a lot of it and mixed it with other questionable herbs, and that's what the goal was, is to vomit. Ilex vomitoria.
Oh, boy. I'm thinking about, on the medicinal side, coxcomb is used in traditional medicine.
Coxcomb celosia?
Yeah, they have the really bright red flowers, that, like the comb of a rooster.
And yeah, well, there's two types of ones that's more plume-like and the other that's coxcomb, which to me looks like brains. You look down on the flower, and especially if you get a round one, it looks like a small, bright red or orange or yellow brain. It's very creepy, but well, cool.
Well, let's turn our attention, and we can come back to spooky plants because there's plenty more we could talk about. Let's talk about woody perennials. Is it too late to plant at this point?
No. In fact, I'm going to this weekend. The most important thing is, you know, water, 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 because eventually the ground will freeze and the uptake of water is arrested and a plant can desiccate over the winter if it's not fully hydrated going into the fall. We're running right near the time when I would say it's stop planting. Evergreens, I think it's a little too late because they're so prone to winter burn and they're hard to keep hydrated if they're newly planted this late. But most deciduous plants, I mean, our city here planted a bunch of street trees recently. So it's not too late. Perennials, it's really getting to the point where we shouldn't, but I have a few I'm going to sneak in before the ground freezes. I just will make sure to mulch them over or provide some protection for them. But I don't want to keep them wet, so I would use something like pine needles or something like that that's lightweight.
Yeah, and you know, mulching, the ones that you do put in, do you wait on the mulch until the ground's froze, or do you mulch them right away?
Well, I use it around the plant right away, and that can be bark mulch, not covering the plant. And then when the ground freezes and things are really starting, the foliage has died off, then I'll scatter a little bit of pine needles. I got a white pine in my yard, so I got plenty of pine needles on top, and that helps insulate it a little bit better. But you don't want to, like, bury it completely.
Yeah, makes sense. And you can join in, too, by the way, as you're listening in. I can't remember if I gave the number or not, so I'll do it right now. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Bill in Janesville, speaking of emails, did email. He had three Blaze Autumn maples planted in various locations in his yards, assuming they are about a year old. Anything special he needs to know or do with them over the winter months?
He said it was recently planted?
planted in various over the summer, he planted them.
Okay. Well, like I mentioned, water, water, water. You know, those plants are not established in the ground yet, and you need to make sure these plants are hydrated very well. And that includes the area, the root ball, that actually went into the ground, not just, you know, the surrounding area, because the roots aren't there yet. We also want to use slow amount of water. So drip hoses, even those gator bags, you know, people put around their trees. I'm not a big fan of them because it keeps the trunk too wet. But other watering devices, if you're not going to do it by hand, you can fill these one's called a tree diaper. I know, silly name, but that's the name. And you could place it on top of the root system, goes around the tree, and it inflates when you add water, and it provides slow drip irrigation to the tree. But you got to come back and fill it up again. It's just not one and done. There's other products out there, but make sure those plants are well watered.
Dave in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, what is the latest for the health of the plant, of the tree, I should water before winter? I'm referring to oak trees, chestnut trees, arborvitae, even apple trees. They're all about a year, maybe even 2 years old. What is the latest that I should be watering them for their benefit?
Until the ground freezes.
Yeah.
That's basically my answer, because once the ground freezes, the water you add isn't going to percolate down into the soil much, especially the evergreens, because if they dry out in the winter, they're toast. So your arborvitae, you won't need it. I mean, you don't want to apply so that it's soaking wet all over the place. You don't want standing water. But you want to do a thorough watering, especially younger trees, to help them get through the winter.
Very, very good advice. And I would just add here something that you should be doing with your outside spigot. When you take the hose off, don't do like I did. I shut the water off inside, but then I didn't open the spigot. And this spring, when I discovered, much to my dismay, that I had to replace the spigot. And fortunately, my neighbor Scott said, "Oh, I just had to do that myself at work." So he went ahead and did it for me. But it's one of those things: shut the water line off inside, open the spigot, and then it's probably a good idea to cover that spigot. They actually even make little coverings for spigots now, so you.
Really?
Yeah, they do. And and you can save yourself a little headache and hassle next year if you do that.
So you leave the spigot open all winter?
Yeah, you can leave the spigot open and then cover it somehow. You know, if you got some bubble wrap or whatever, just cover it up with some tape and bubble wrap. And there you go.
Great.
And that I can speak from experience on that, because it's it wasn't too expensive for me. All I had to pay for was this new spigots and so forth. But and Scott did the installation for free, so I was happy for that. All right, so something to consider right at the end when you want to get the hose off and put away for winter. And don't forget to drain the hose out, too, while you're at it. Carolyn and Madison, we'll move on to you. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I've got lots of bloodroot this year. I don't know why it generated and filled so much space last year. But my dirt has, so I want people to give plants away, or the rhizomes, to anybody who's interested in growing it. And now I think the best time to transplant it. But the dirt has jumping worms in it. Okay. And their egg sacs are like coffee grounds. Okay. And so is the dirt that they produce. So we have to wash the rhizomes.
Yeah, I'd be really careful about giving them to anybody else if you have jumping worms.
Yep, I would too. I don't suggest it.
What about transplanting bloodroot? Is it too late? It'd be too late to transplant?
I'd wait till spring. Yeah. I'd wait till spring.
I would wait till spring too, I think. It's getting pretty late, even in the Madison area. Certainly further north, it's even less likely you're going to have success, I would guess. Laura Jowell, our guest with us, Associate Professor, Extension Specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, talking about all kinds of things relating to woody ornamentals. And you can join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at trees, shrubs, woody ornamentals today with our guest Laura Jowell from the UW College of Ag and Life Sciences, where she is an associate professor and horticulturist. Great to have her with us. Again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Just a quick note, in the second hour of the show, we'll talk about growing mushrooms with Sean Kuhn of Vitruvian Farms. He's a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland area. So we'll talk mushrooms, but I'm sure we'll get into vegetable topics as well as we move along. But right now, zeroing in on those woody perennials, for example, what about cutting those perennials? Should we wait or do it now?
I personally wait until they died back naturally and then remove the foliage, or you can leave it there. You don't have to, pick it up. But I say this with caution. If you have any foliar diseases or diseases in general, I would cut and remove that foliage now because the spores can overwinter in the ground over winter, and you don't want to reinfect your plants next spring. But generally, I wait till my hostas, for example, die back. They turn yellow and they start to die back, and then I remove the foliage.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. You might as well give the sun a chance to work on the leaves until they pass away.
Yeah.
Marion in Roxton, Illinois, will go to you now. Hi, Marion.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Over the summer, I had some hydrangeas that were blooming beautifully. One was the purple color, the other pink. And I've left them in the pot during the summer and kept them well watered. But now I want to try to put them in the ground. Is it too late to put them in the ground and hope they come back in the spring? They aren't very big plants. I cut some of the height off of them when the blooms withered and got brown. So now there are maybe 6 to 8 inches high above the pot. So they aren't real big.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you have the mop head type of hydrangea, Hydrangea macrophylla. Do you happen to know the cultivars of them?
No.
That you have? Okay. No, that's okay. And she's referring to the one, actually there's two species of hydrangea, that the flowers turn blue in acid soils, acidic soils, which we don't have in most of south central Wisconsin, and they turn pink in higher pH soils. They're both beautiful. The problem is they're very borderline hardy. I've had some in my yard that, you know, they said, oh, they bloom on old and new wood. Well, they didn't come up at all the next year. They were a very expensive annual. We've not had good luck with them at the Arboretum either for overwintering or poor flower production. I have one at home that does flower every year, and it's called Twist and Shout. And that one, mine is actually purple because my soil pH there is near neutral. So, but anyways, that one has come back reliably. You can try planting them in the ground, but realize they may not come back next year or flower next year. Or you can do, and I do this with my some of my tender woodies. I have them growing in a pot. I water them very well right before I move them to an unheated garage. and I store them there in the garage over winter. Now, you do need to check at least once a month or so to see if it's all dried out. The pot will freeze, the roots will freeze, the top will freeze, but it's above temperatures that may drastically kill it. And I've been successful in doing that. So those are your two options.
Yeah, I wouldn't put them right on the floor. I'd put a board on them or under them or something, I think, in a garage.
Yeah.
But that's worth a try, Marion. Give it a go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. What about shrubs? Can we be pruning shrubs now?
Well, it depends which kind of shrub. If it's one of the dieback shrubs, for example, like the bush clover, Lespediza, that one you can cut back now to the ground. You can also do that to Russian sage, which most people consider it a herbaceous perennial, but actually it's kind of woody at the base. That you can cut back now. Vitex or chast tree, that's another one you can cut back now. Now, when it comes to many other shrubs, dormant season pruning is wonderful. I do a lot of my pruning in late winter. You have to wait. You know, you could do it now, but you have to wait until all the leaves have fallen off. And even so, I would personally wait until very early spring. Now, if you're going to prune in very early spring and it's a spring flowering plant, realize you are cutting off some of the flower buds and you wouldn't hack the whole thing back. Or you can wait to prune until right after they flower. That way you're not sacrificing flowers. Or if it's a summer flowering plant, or fall flowering plant, those set their flower buds in spring. So technically in the fall, you can do some pruning, but wait until all the leaves have fallen off. And November, December, January, February, March are good times of year.
All right. And hydrangeas, somebody else had a question about hydrangeas, fall care, and I guess we kind of covered that for our emailer.
Watering and mulching the ground. If you're going to use mulch, I personally like wood chips or shredded bark, and make sure you're putting on no more than 3 to 4 inches, and you keep it away from the base of the plant, whether it's a tree or a shrub. You don't want any bark touching the wood because it will rot.
Yeah.
The trunk. Yeah, you don't want that.
Some plant stores have, right now, there are shrub sales going on.
Yep.
Good time to buy them right now?
Well, you know, if the ground isn't frozen and it's a deciduous shrub, you can still plant it now, but you're getting close to the end, and you need to make sure it's well watered. Trees right now, you know, a lot of cities are putting in trees that are just about defoliated. That's, you know, for the winter. That's fine to do right now, but it's really too late for evergreens.
Yeah, I think that makes really, really good sense. But what are the odds that they're going to survive? Like, you put a tree in now, that should be okay, I guess?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, our city, municipality here, that where I live, they're putting in trees now. I've seen them, a lot of people put in trees now because, you know, especially after the leaves drop, you know, those trees are entering dormancy, but the root growth still continues until the ground freezes. That's why it's so important to get these plants watered and apply mulch at the base of the plant, but not touching the bark of the trunk or of the base of a shrub. You don't want it touching it.
Carl in Hayward has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carl.
Hello. My question is, it's kind of a comment more than a question both. I live in northern Wisconsin in Hayward. I hunt moose in Ontario every other year in northern Ontario near Armstrong Station. And we have the same type of popple, aspen, spruce, and birch. And up there, it is so noticeable that the birch grow almost twice as tall, the aspen grow almost twice as tall, and they grow a lot older to 120 to 130 years, just for an example of the aspen and the spruce. And my theory is, and my question is, if I'm right or wrong, but I have a feeling that they have a longer growing, cold growing season in Ontario than we do in northern Wisconsin. So as I understand, the slower something grows, the older it can get, the tougher it can get, the taller it can get. Am I right or wrong?
Well, there's a number of factors that are in play here. First of all, it's a cooler environment, and they're not stressed from heat from cities. And so something like quaking aspen, that typically doesn't live more than 50 years, even in Colorado, and they form these huge colonies. And they just root sucker and keep on root suckering, and that's why, you know, one tree can sustain the land for a long time because of all these new suckers coming up. As the older trees die, you get new shoots coming up from the ground, so it's constantly being replenished. Spruce trees can live a long time, depending on the spruce. I imagine probably way up there it's white spruce. You've also got the cool climate coming off. I'm not sure how close you are to the Great Lake, where you are in Ontario, but that helps too. Nice cool breezes coming off the lake do not heat stress the plants as much. That's probably why you're seeing some of these trees doing so well, is they're in the right environment. Same with white birch. You take a white birch and you put it in your front yard, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to eventually come down with bronze birch borer, which is an insect that is attracted to stressed trees, which when you take them out of the woods, they are stressed. And they're often drought stressed and heat stressed, and they become more susceptible to various insects and diseases.
Yeah, so the stress factor, that's really interesting. Carl, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in Cleveland, Wisconsin, we'll turn to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I have two quick questions. I have a really nice little Rose of Sharon that seems to be getting more and more blossoms every year. And I have a magnolia bush that has been blooming twice a year. But I'd like to shape up the magnolia is a bush, the Rose of Sharon is a tree. Can I prune back some of the bottom branches now, or do I wait till spring?
I personally would wait until spring on the Rose of Sharon. Rose of Sharon is considered a large shrub, and you're very lucky that you can grow it. I tried several cultivars in my yard in Dane County, and they winter killed pretty severely, so I removed them. But that one blooms on new wood. It's a summer bloomer, so by removing some branches now, you're not going to deprive yourself of blooming in the summertime. Now, the magnolia, you said, is a bush. It's probably just a low branch tree form. The smallest one I can think of is star magnolia, but star magnolia eventually gets, you know, 25 feet tall, and it's just really slow growing. I would watch for magnolia scale on that, because we've had a big outbreak of that in Dane County. That one I would wait until late winter, early spring. But remember, you are removing flower buds on those branches that you are removing.
And you mentioned magnolia scale. What do you look for?
Well, it's an insect. It's actually the adult female that gets on branches of, and trunks even, of magnolia trees, and she lays eggs. And the female, after she's done laying eggs, dies, but it's sitting on top of the egg mass. So it to protect the eggs until next spring when the crawlers come out. I actually physically used my fingernail to scrape, I know it sounds gross, but to scrape the scale off. You can use dormant oil sprays to smother the egg masses. It's something you really need to get a hold of, because it can kill your tree.
Mary, something to think about. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And those masses, do they get very big? Are they, you know, inch or?
No, you know, it depends how heavy your infestation is. I mean, I've seen branches that were just coated with magnolia scale. You can Google magnolia scale and a picture will come up. You can see what it looks like. But it's different than lenticels that occur on the branches.
Mike in Poinette, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about a couple of blueberry plants that I have in a raised bed. I've had them for 6 or 7 years. I've been pruning them in the spring of the year, and I'm considering putting them in the ground instead of my raised bed. And I'm wondering, when is the best time to put those into the ground? And should I prune them before or after? What should I be doing with those?
Okay. Blueberries produce their flowers on older wood. So by pruning them in spring, you are removing flower buds, i.e. fruit. So I would wait until after they're done fruiting, immediately after, then I would prune because they haven't set their flower buds in the summer for next spring's bloom yet. I would not prune them right now unless it's a broken branch, for example. Transplanting them, I'm not sure where in the state you are located.
Poinette,
okay. You can't transplant them now. The hardest thing about growing blueberries in your yard, and I love them, and I absolutely love blueberries on my cereal in the morning. They need a very acidic soil, well-drained, sandy loam, with some peat. They need that. They need that acid soil. And around Poinette, south-central part of the state, it's not acidic. And that's why a lot of people put them in raised beds, because they bring in soil and they amend that soil a lot. And you're going to need to add sulfur. It's not easy to lower the pH of soil. It's a very long process. And because we have a lot of limestone in our subsoil, the soil pH may go down with the addition of sulfur, and then it's going to slowly rise again. And you're constantly going to be, you know, up and down with it. I do know people that have blueberries, but they're in the north central to northern part of the state where the soil is much more conducive to growing them.
Yeah, if you're going to do that, if you're going to transplant them to the soil, I guess I would be wanting to amend that soil before I did it. Right?
Well, you're going to want to do a soil test first.
Yes.
To determine what your pH is. And if your pH is anything over 7.4, boy, that's going to be hard to get that down because blueberries like it at around 5.5 to 6 pH, maybe even lower, to get the best. So the plants don't get chlorotic and not do well.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned soil tests, and boy, this is a really good time of the year to do a soil test, and no matter what you're growing, to be perfectly honest, because the labs are not so busy now as they will be next spring.
Right, right. And as long as you can get a soil probe into the ground, you're going to want to take more than one sample. The ground isn't frozen yet. You can get the sample. Do several. If you go online to University of Wisconsin Soil and Plant Analysis Lab, they can tell you how to do soil samples. You're going to want to take it in several locations and mix it up in a plastic bucket. You don't want to use metal. And then send sample off, and they'll give you some results.
Yeah. Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Laura Jell, our guest today, as we talk, well, we're covering a lot of things today on the show, but zeroing in a little on perennials, trees, and shrubs. It's great to have her with us, and you can join in. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick note, on Monday, we will be hearing a lot of things. First, about a podcast that shares stories of growing up on the farm, a very fun podcast. Then we talk about growing and cooking with soy. And lastly, we talked to a coffee expert about how to brew the best cup. That's on Monday. Right now, though, Laura Jowell, our guest today, an expert on woody ornamentals, nursery management, landscape installation and maintenance, and tree care. So give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello, Larry. It's so nice to talk to you. Well, I bought some beat-up blueberry plants. You know, they were going to throw them out. And I planted them. I have, in my back lot, I have quite a bit. Anyways, a row of evergreens. And I planted them all, maybe 5-6 feet from them. And they are going nuts. I get so many blueberries. The plants went nuts because of all the acid in the soil.
Yeah.
And I get so many blueberries. My freezer is half full. I get so many blueberries. My boyfriend has resorted to making blueberry wine.
Yum.
Well, Cheryl, you are the blueberry queen of Bessemer, Michigan, from the sound of it.
Yeah. Oh. I think that's in the UP.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad you called with that story. And blueberry wine, if you want to pass along some when the next time you're in the Madison area, I'll be happy to give it a sample. There you go. Thanks, Cheryl. Oh, boy. Diane in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. I have two approximately 10, 12-year-old oak trees, and I'm wondering if I can trim some of the lower branches back right now. And then I have a second question regarding a fuzzy-looking growth on the leaves.
Is the growth on the leaves of the oaks?
Correct. And it was yellow and fuzzy.
The first thing that comes to mind is powdery mildew, but that's white. That's not yellow. I would send a sample. Do you still have it?
It looked like it. They're all dried up right now, but more evident when they were green.
Yeah, I don't know what it is from your description. I would probably take pictures for sure, or send a sample to the plant UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And Brian Huddleston is wonderful. He'll take a look at it to make sure. I can't really tell from what you're describing on the phone. Regarding pruning branches on oaks, with oaks and elms especially, you do not want to prune any branches on them during the growing season. So we recommend don't prune oaks or elms after April. I personally like April 1st because we've been getting warmer Aprils, April weather. So wait until the leaves have dropped off, and you know, as soon as they're all dropped off for the fall and into the winter, you can prune them.
So
the insect that transfers oak wilt, the picnic beetle, is not active in winter.
Yeah, I'd wait. And if you want to do it now or this fall, I'd still, it was me, I'd wait a little while.
Wait a couple weeks, yeah. I think it's a little early. I would wait until probably mid-December before I think about doing that.
Yeah, and Diane's in Lake Mills, so she's south here, so.
Yeah.
Wait, Diane, and then next spring, if that shows up again, that yellow fuzzy business, get some photos, and you know, Brian might even be able to tell from a photo, which you could send, or send a sample, and he can definitely then figure it out. Ken in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have a hedge along a garage side. The hedge is about 40 feet in length, and it's grown up to be about 4 feet high, and I need it to be more like 3 feet high. How much can I cut it back? Can I cut it back to where I lose most of the green without hurting it that badly? And what's the season to do that if I can cut it back?
Okay. Do you know what the plant is?
Yews, I think.
Oh, yews.
Yes, it is yews.
Okay. Yeah, yews. I personally would wait until spring to do that. I don't like to remove that a foot's worth of growth. That's quite a bit. If it's getting, I don't know what cultivar of yew you have, you know, they're not meant to stay small. They get bigger. But there are some cultivars that are smaller than others. But you, I would wait until spring. And then, you know, I'm not a big fan of hedge shears. I know it's 40 feet long. I used to do landscape maintenance, and we pruned everything by hand with a pair of pruners. And one thing about doing that, you're doing selective cuts, and you're cutting it back, always cut it back to a side branch that's slightly larger than the one you removed. Nice thing about yews, they can tolerate a lot of shearing as well as pruning, and they will send up new shoots, and it will fill in. But, yeah, I would wait until spring for that.
There you go, Ken. Thank you very much. Bob in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there? Let's turn to Linda in New Glarus then. Linda, hi.
Hello, Larry. I have a question about a shrub, which I believe is a sweet box. It's a native of China, and I've noticed there have been several of these shrubs pop up on my property in the last few years, and I'm wondering if it's now considered an invasive in Wisconsin.
Sweet box. Well, that can be a couple different plants that have the same common name. It's not boxwood. Regular boxwood, which is buxus, is not invasive. And in fact, we're losing a lot of our boxwoods around because of various insects and diseases. The other plant that I know as sweet box is, I'm looking up in my book here, sweet box is Sarococca hucuriana. And that plant I knew in the South, it is hardy to zone 6. It's not hardy here. And I've never seen it available for sale here, rightfully so. So I'm not quite sure what plant you're talking about. Is this herbaceous or is this woody?
I'm talking about the second one that you mentioned, the Sucurama.
Yeah, that is not. And where are you located?
New Glarus.
New Glarus. That shouldn't be grown around here. That's not hardy.
But it's growing.
Yeah. I've never heard it becoming invasive. You know, we had it as in the southern, when I was in the south, that was a common landscape plant, but that was for zone 7. So I'm not sure who's selling this. They shouldn't be.
Oh, but here it is growing in Linda's yard.
Yeah, that's really weird.
So it is, Linda, to answer your question, it is not considered an invasive here because it's going to die in most places, and you must have a very unusual location where you're getting some warmer temperatures than a lot of other people would be getting.
Yeah, and it's an evergreen that spreads by rhizomes, and it does form colonies, but I wouldn't consider it invasive. I mean, if we get a hard winter, I'm just going to take those out.
Yeah. Linda, there you go. Thank you for calling. I think we've got Bob in Madison with us. Let's go there now. Bob, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have a little devil nine bark, and it's very beautiful, but some of the stalks have gotten tall and leggy, and they're flopping over in the garden. When's the best time to prune, and how do we prune it?
I have a nine bark in my yard, and I've done pretty drastic pruning on them, cutting them way back, leave several buds behind. And it'll take a couple years before it really starts to fill in again. That's one way of pruning it. I usually wait until late winter, early spring, realize you're not going to have any flowers that year. But that's one way of pruning it. The other way of pruning it is to selectively remove the larger diameter branches back to the base of the plant, leave some growth behind that's shorter and not as leggy, and it will send up new shoots and eventually fill in nicely. So those are the two ways you can do it, and both of which I personally would do late winter, early spring.
Sort of like lilacs on that second one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And cut the biggest one out, the biggest ones out, maybe a third of them, and go from there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bob, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jim wanted to know the latest on the emerald ash borer.
Well, I'm not an entomologist, but emerald ash borer is here all over Wisconsin, and it's affects all ash trees, you know, white ash, blue ash, green ash, and black ash. Black ash grows in the swamps up north. It's devastating. It's lethal. If you suspect, actually, even if you don't suspect, if you have an ash tree in your yard and you really want to save it, you need to have it injected with a systemic insecticide. It's usually done in in spring, and a company has to be hired. It's a restricted-use pesticide. It is not a spray. You can have it injected into your tree by experts, and it's taken up in the plant. I do it to my white ash every 2 years. It's something. I have a really nice autumn purple white ash, and it's about the biggest shade tree in my yard. I don't want it to die. But if you do nothing about it, it's going to come. I mean, emerald ash borer is everywhere, and if you don't treat your trees as a preventative, you'll probably get it and lose your tree.
Yeah. Now, the cost of that's going to vary a little bit around the state, but what is what's a basic rough figure for that?
I'm not quite sure because I know rates go up and down. I just pay the person, the guy that does it for me. It's based on the calipers of the tree. If you go up to a tree, the diameter of the tree, that's not the circumference, but the diameter is what determines how much product you use, and that determines the price. It's going to be several hundred dollars. But if you have a nice, old, or really beautiful ash tree, it's worth doing.
Well, yeah, so let's say it's $200. You do it every 2 years, so it's $100 a year.
Right,
to keep,
right.
To keep a tree like that, it is well worth the money.
Oh, yes. It provides air conditioning to your house in the summer. It has many beneficial benefits for the environment. I mean, it's a wonderful home for birds and squirrels. And it is the product is applied and not at the time of flowering of the plant. And anyways, the flowers are wind pollinated. They're not insect pollinated. Yes, it can attract some bees. I'm not saying it doesn't, but the choice is yours whether you want to do it or not. I would, because I like old trees, and I don't want to see all, especially white ashes, destroyed by this horrible insect.
I'm with you, Laura. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Laura. Laura Jull, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison, been our guest. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to mushrooms. We can talk about some other vegetables as well with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to turn our attention, for a bit at least, to mushrooms. They're having a popularity boom, especially because of their nutritional benefits. And we'll be talking about mushrooms and other vegetables with our guest, Sean Kuhn. Sean is the second time I think he's visited us. He's the co-founder of Vitruvian Farms. It's a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland. He's the primary farmer on the team researching, troubleshooting, and implementing fixes for just about every produce growing issue you can imagine. He's also knowledgeable about food, our food system, and nutritional aspects of the food, all the food they grow. So I hope you'll join in with your questions for Sean. Maybe you're interested in growing mushrooms, or what would you like to know about growing greens, even when the weather turns cold like it is? What other growing questions do you have? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Sean Kuhn, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Larry.
Let's talk about Vitruvian Farms. How'd you get it started?
Randomly met my business partner, Tommy, in college. We were both studying different things, and we started learning about things that we thought were going wrong with the food system, how food is got tons of pesticides and herbicides on it, and we kind of veered off our original path that we intended for college, decided we wanted to help make the food system better, and we decided to get into farming.
Yeah, yes, that it's crazy in a way to think, just a chance meeting turns into a friendship, which turns into a business partnership. What kinds of products do you offer now?
Yeah, so we grow a wide array of vegetables, everything from salad greens, heads of lettuce, scallions, turnips, green onions, pretty much most things. And then we also grow specialty mushrooms indoors. We grow the mushrooms year-round, so we're producing things like shiitake, maitake, lion's mane, oyster, and black king mushrooms.
Yeah, a lot of them, and I want to get into that. But I also wanted to talk for at least a minute about you've got a store, grocery store. How's that working?
Yep, we just opened our store a little over 2 years ago. It kind of grew out of previous to the pandemic, we were like 80% wholesale to restaurants, and when they were shutting restaurants down, we needed to find a different way to sell our produce to people. And so we started an online store and a home delivery service. We started aggregating stuff that we weren't producing from other local growers and makers to make a more economical delivery system. And after the pandemic ended, we built a building and essentially opened a locally focused grocery store offering all those same products that we offered and that we still offer through our home delivery service. So we essentially have a mini grocery store on the farm with a focus on organic products and locally made products.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And the delivery, is it like a CSA or how does it work, the delivery?
Yeah, so we do a CSA and we offer home delivery for that. We run a CSA for about 20 weeks during the summer. And some people get delivery. You can get that delivered right to your door. We also have our online store, so you can just pick out anything you want on a week-to-week basis and then get that delivered right to your door.
Yeah, and your store is located, of course, McFarland.
Yep, right on the farm. So we're about 15 minutes south of Madison, right off of Highway 51.
Yeah. Well, last time you were with us, we had just started talking about mushrooms, but we kind of ran out of time. So let's start there. Why are, mushrooms are getting a lot of really good press these days. Why is that the case, do you think?
I think there was a couple really good documentaries that came out in the last 5 years or so that sparked people's interest. And basically, there's a lot of research going on right now with a lot of compounds in the mushrooms that we're just kind of beginning to understand, but they're finding a lot of health promoting benefits with those compounds, things like regeneration for your brain cells, immune system benefits. And as that research is coming out and it's being publicized by people like Paul Stamets, a lot of people have caught on to that recently. And so they're trying to introduce more mushrooms into their diet.
And I guess if you look at mushrooms, you think about button mushrooms and some of the lion's mane and some of the ones that you mentioned. And again, remind me which varieties you grow. And I'm wondering if some are better than others when it comes to the nutritional side of things.
Yeah, so we're growing five different varieties right now. They're wood-eating mushrooms. So in comparison to button mushrooms are secondary decomposers. So they're actually, their food source is a compost, taking vegetables, basically vegetable-like products that have already been decomposed one time and then producing mushrooms. Our mushrooms are actually directly decomposing wood sawdust. And so we're growing shiitake, maitake, lion's mane, oyster, and black kings. And yeah, I would say they all have, it gets kind of complicated with the different nutritional aspects of the different mushrooms, but I would say all the specialty mushrooms that we're growing, I would say are a little bit higher on the nutritional value than something like a button mushroom.
Okay. So for the home gardener, somebody who said, okay, I want to give mushrooms a try. What varieties do you suggest for a first try?
One of the easiest things that you could do if you wanted to dabble in mushrooms would be planting some almond agaricus mushrooms, which this is a really simple method. So if you spread wood mulch in your yard or under trees or something like that, you can buy spawn from a local company. There's one in northern Wisconsin called Field and Forest. You buy some mushroom spawn, which is the mycelium that's already growing, and you just kind of sprinkle that into the wood chips and wait anywhere, depending on the season, anywhere from 1 to 2 months, and the mushroom grows out, and then they'll start basically popping out of the ground. That's probably one of the easiest ways you could dabble in growing mushrooms. Another very simple way to grow mushrooms at home would be growing oyster mushrooms on straw. That's actually how we started growing mushrooms. I mentioned before that these are wood decomposing mushrooms, but the oyster mushroom is very prolific, so it will actually take straw as a food source. So what you would want to do is you'd want to heat that straw in water to kill competing organisms. It's basically like a pasteurization. So if you could bring the straw up to about 160 degrees or so for around 2 hours, you kill most competing organisms that the mushroom would have to compete with. Then you drain that straw out, and then you could pack it into 5-gallon buckets. You could pack it into plastic bags, and then you basically poke holes in the bag or the bucket, and you inoculate it with some grain spawn. And give it time to incubate, and after a period of 2 to 4 weeks, mushrooms should be popping out of the container.
And maybe you have more mushrooms than you know what to do with them.
Yep, they're very fast growing.
So what about location? What kind of location works the best?
Well, if you want to optimize the growing conditions, there's really two different main phases for growing the mushroom. The first is incubation. So that's the period after you've treated your substrate to kill competing organisms and you've inoculated it with your grain spawn. Most of these mushrooms typically grow best around 65 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. If they get warmer than that, it's not a favorable environment for the mushroom to grow. So if you can keep it somewhere in that temperature range, they're going to grow out the quickest. Then when you fruit them, what you want to do is you want to decrease the temperature something more around 60 to 65 degrees, and that cold is one of the signals the mushroom mycelium uses to know that it's time to produce fruit bodies. So during incubation, somewhere dark, somewhere that's 65, 70 degrees, and then when it's time to fruit, you want to introduce them to fresh air, and then you also want them to grow out in a very humid environment. Mushrooms are, the fruit bodies are 90% water, essentially. So we keep our mushrooms, when they're fruiting, around 85 to 95% relative humidity. You could achieve that in a very simple way by having them in a shaded area where you run a garden sprinkler once in a while. If you want to get more technical, you could put them in some sort of plastic canopy with a humidification system or like a mister, because as that mushroom is growing, if you're not supplying humidity, then they'll kind of dry out.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. How do you like to store mushrooms? I mean, in your situation, you're growing a heck of a lot of mushrooms, but even a home gardener might wind up with more than he or she needs instantly. How do you store them?
Yeah, the best way to store them would be putting them into a paper bag, closing the paper bag, and then keeping it in the crisper in your refrigerator. And depending on how fresh they were when you harvested them, they could last at least 2 weeks in there, maybe up to 4 weeks. They might dry out a little bit on the higher end there. But a paper bag is much preferred over plastic, because in the plastic bag, the mushroom will kind of release a little bit of moisture, and then that moisture is trapped in there. And there's a tendency for the mushrooms to get kind of soggy and rotty. So the paper bag allows just enough of that humidity to escape from the bag while still keeping enough in that the mushroom doesn't dry out too fast.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sean Kuhn, our guest today, the co-founder of Vitruvian Farms. It's a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland. Questions for him, maybe about mushrooms, maybe about other types of herbs or vegetables. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sean Kuhn of Vitruvian Farms, a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm located in and near McFarland, Wisconsin. Great to have him with us. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Next week on Garden Talk, by the way, we'll talk with Liz Freemuth from The Garden Hoe about adaptable plants, and then we'll hear about a group that is researching the pawpaw plant. But right now, we zeroed in a bit on mushroom, but taking other vegetable or herb questions as well at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. Amy in Iola, thank you for joining us. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sean. I started mushrooms on logs several years ago, like four. And I started two varieties. One was shiitake, the other one I don't remember. And the shiitake grew really well, and then the other one grew the following year. And now they aren't growing. And I'm wondering if I've picked them incorrectly. Am I supposed to snip them off or pull them out? I did pull bark off if I pulled the mushrooms out. And or do they just not last? But I have no mushrooms now.
Okay.
Yeah, you can pick those or cut them off. I'd probably recommend picking them off. Where do you have them stored?
They're on the ground, on a pallet kind of situation. It's actually on two other logs. They're in the shade.
And is it shaded?
And I water them.
Yeah.
Yes, and I water them.
Okay. Yeah, they can sometimes be, like, they'll naturally flush. I can speak more to shiitake on logs. I think a lot of them will naturally flush maybe twice a year, once in spring and once in fall. they're looking for specific temperatures is when they're going to want to fruit. And it sounds like you're keeping them watered. I know outdoor growers who are using shiitake log production, they actually dunk their logs. They submerge them completely in water for like 24 hours, I believe. And then you take them out and that will kind of initiate a flush. It'll rehydrate the log, kind of cold snaps the mushrooms so that the mushrooms will produce. So I would say dunking the logs could be something that you could try. You definitely want to keep them in a mostly shaded area, maybe 70% shade or so, so it's not too hot for them. And then you can additionally run a sprinkler every so often, maybe a couple times a week, just to keep them moist. But you shouldn't have a problem picking them off. That should be totally fine. I know a lot of growers that do that. And I think you would be fine cutting them off as well.
All right. Amy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Myron emailed to ask how to select fresh mushrooms. What do you look for?
I would look for mushrooms that haven't dried out too much. Mushrooms that you don't see any sort of discoloration on them, like any sort of green or blue kind of mold looking contamination. Sometimes with oyster mushrooms, you'll see a little bit of white fuzz on the top of the caps. That's actually just the, if it's, as long as it's white, that's typically actually just the mycelium of the mushroom itself, and that's totally fine. But if you see any sort of other kind of mold looking contamination that would be blue or green, you'd want to steer clear of that. Any sort of like black spotting on the undersides of the caps, definitely if they're dried out. Although if they're dried out, you can rehydrate them. It's not necessarily that they're bad to eat. It's just that they're a little bit on the older side. And then I typically look for mushrooms where the cap is not super frayed, where it's relatively intact.
There you go. And thanks very much for that question, Myron. Appreciate it very much. In your experience, what are the more difficult, let's say we've got an advanced grower here, what are the more difficult ones to raise, and what are the best ways to do them?
Well, I would say out of everything that we're growing right now, the trickiest are the lion's mane and the maitake. Lion's mane is tricky because they get really finicky with too much airflow. So in our mushroom fruit chambers, the mushrooms are breathing in oxygen and they're exhaling CO2 just like we are. So we constantly have to bring fresh air into the fruit chamber so the mushroom can breathe and develop properly. But with lion's mane, they're very prone to drying out. So if you have too much airflow in there, they can start to turn yellow or they won't form properly. So finding the proper balance of keeping the room humidified while bringing in fresh air, but not having too much air blowing on the mushrooms is a very challenging part of growing those. The maitake, which is also known as hen of the woods, is a newer mushroom that we've been growing. It's not wildly cultivated because it's extremely tricky. And I would say growers don't fully have it understood what the different parameters are for successfully growing maitake indoors. But it has a very different fruiting habit than most other mushrooms. With most of our mushrooms, during the incubation phase, we don't want them to enter primordia formation, which basically means they're starting to produce their mushroom heads. With the maitake, we actually want them to start fruiting during incubation. So they actually start their fruit process much earlier than the other mushrooms before we bring them over to the fruit chambers. So I would say maitake and the lion's mane are two of our more challenging mushrooms to grow.
And you mentioned your fruiting chambers, and you know, that brings to mind, what do your fruiting chambers look like?
Yeah, we have a couple different fruiting chambers. Some of them are kind of, you could think of them as like a little grow tent. They're mylar plastic walls that are enclosed. We have fans bringing fresh air into the rooms, and we have humidifiers set up in the room. So we have these little misters that go off on a timer, and that atomizes water, creates kind of a fog, and keeps the humidity of the room oscillating between 85% to 95% humidity. We also have a different type of fruit chamber that's a little bit newer, which is essentially a refurbished shipping container cooler. So it was a shipping container that was refrigerated, used on the high seas, that we bought new, and basically the same outfitting where we're bringing fresh air into the room with fans. We have humidifiers running inside the room, and then there's shelving inside the rooms to hold the mushroom blocks.
Pretty cool. And you're certified organic. You know, what does that mean when growing mushrooms?
For the mushrooms, so it mostly comes down to the food source. So we have two different food sources for the mushrooms. The shiitake and maitake grow on a substrate that is 70% red oak sawdust and 30% organic wheat mids. Wheat mids is kind of like it's kind of like wheat bran with a little bit more chaff and things like that in there.
Yeah.
It's a source of nitrogen. The rest of the mushrooms that we grow it's a mixture of 50% red oak sawdust and 50% soybean hulls, which is a byproduct from soybean processing. When it comes to organic certification, there really isn't any certified organic sawdust. So how the organic regulations look at that is they look at, as long as it hasn't been treated with anything, they consider it fine, a natural substance for the mushrooms to use as a feed source. But then those agricultural products that we add, which is the soybean hulls and the wheat mids, those need to be certified organic, because those would have a much greater likelihood of being contaminated with a pesticide or something like that if it was grown non-organically.
Do we have that growing organically in our state?
The soybean hulls?
Yeah.
We do. We used to mix our own substrate from loose soybean hulls and from loose sawdust. And more recently, we've been buying a pelleted. It's basically a company that takes those two ingredients and uses pressure to compress it into little pellets, kind of like what you would use to heat a wood stove. They look just like that. We found this company that makes a really great substrate for us, so we're buying that from out of state right now.
Yeah. But you do a lot of business with a lot of other local groups, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. But I'm wondering about eating. You know, you've got most of us are very used to something like a button mushroom, and you can use it, you know, sauteed. You can do whatever you want with them. But what about some of these other mushrooms like lion's mane? How do you like to eat lion's mane?
Yeah. The one thing I always recommend people do is look up Paul Stamets on YouTube. You can listen to him. He's a really smart mycologist. But something that people don't always recognize is that you should always cook your mushrooms and always cook them well. Mushrooms can have compounds that are slightly toxic. Those compounds, if not cooked, those compounds break down completely to inert substances once you cook the mushroom. So number one, no matter how you're cooking them, you always want to cook your mushrooms well. And mushrooms tend to hold a really good texture, even if you cook them for a long time. For me, I'm mostly sauteing all of my mushrooms. So I'm sauteing them in a pan with either olive oil or butter, and then adding them to whatever dish I'm working with. But baking is also an option. I don't necessarily boil my mushrooms, but I think sauteing is probably one of the most popular things to do. Yeah. Interesting thing with lion's mane is you can make little kind of crab cakes with them. So you kind of just tear up the lion's mane mushroom into little shreds, And then you can sometimes mix that with like a tuna or something like that and breadcrumbs. And you can make these little pancakes and you just fry those in a pan. It's essentially a little crab cake because the lion's mane, a lot of people think it has a somewhat seafood-like flavor to it.
That sounds good. I'm hungry. I wish you were here in the studio with me with some of those all made up and ready to eat. Thanks, John, for that. Sandy in Delavan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. So here's my situation. I'll make a long story short. About a year-ish ago, I found a brown paper bag in the back of my refrigerator. It turned out to be some maitake that I had bought and unbelievably forgotten about. And they were all dried up. Now, at the time, I didn't know if it was safe or not, so I just got rid of them. But something like that, I mean, they were basically just dehydrated mushrooms. Would they have been safe to eat or...
All right. Yep. What about Sandy's maitakes?
Yep, that's happened to me too. If you find your mushrooms, they're all dried out and you don't see any sort of green or blue mold on them or anything like that, I would say they're more than likely safe to eat. And basically what you can do is you can just let them soak in a cold water bath for 20, 30 minutes and those mushrooms will kind of rehydrate. Because when you go to the store, you can buy already dehydrated mushrooms. You basically would cook those in the same exact way as you would the dry already dried mushrooms. You would rehydrate them and then just use them as normal. If you're not seeing any visible colored contamination, then they're most likely, exactly like you said, just dehydrated.
Sandy, there you go. You might have been able to eat those maitakes. Oh, boy. Brian emailed. He says his mother is allergic to mushrooms. Is that a common allergy? And what are good mushroom alternatives for recipes that call for mushrooms?
Some people are we're kind of in this realm right now where a lot of people are trying mushrooms they've never tried before. I have heard of people being allergic to different types. I know I gave my dad a lion's mane supplement at one point, and he said it thought it made his throat kind of close up. I think it's relatively rare, but different mushrooms can have different reactions with people. I would probably recommend, if you're trying a new mushroom, to try a small amount out at first. And kind of going back to what I said earlier, definitely make sure that you're cooking your mushrooms, because the greatest incidents I ever hear of people having a bad reaction was either that they didn't cook the mushroom or they undercooked the mushroom.
Yeah. So you're sauteing. How long are you sauteing mushrooms, for example?
I'm probably sauteing them for around 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay. So it's a little longer than most of us would think about. So it's good to know, 15 to 20.
And like I said, with the mushroom, mushrooms don't tend to kind of lose their ideal texture if you just cook them a little bit longer. It's not like meat where if you overcook it, it's no longer going to be where you want it to be. So I typically say it's better to play it safe and cook them a little bit more than a little bit less.
Yeah, that does make really good sense. Well, besides mushrooms, what kind of produce are you growing now?
Yeah, so this basically right now we're harvesting a lot of salad mix and lettuce heads out of the greenhouses. We have some red radishes and Hakuri turnips coming out of the greenhouses. We produce microgreens all throughout the year in one of our heated greenhouses. Out in the fields, we're pulling out storage radishes, winter radishes like beauty hearts and daikons. We're pulling out getting ready to pull out our winter storage carrots and storage beets. At this point in the year, most things are out of the fields outside. So we have a couple things that are still growing out there, and we have them covered with frost blankets in anticipation of the cold night coming up on Saturday night. And we're converting over to mostly just greenhouse harvesting at this point.
So, but a lot of different things. And let's talk about those salad mixes. Can we do those well in the home? Can we grow them?
Salad, like during this time of year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say we're nearing the end of where you can safely be harvesting outside just because the night temperatures are getting pretty low. Like I said, we have some lettuce still growing outside, and we have it covered with a Agribond row cover, which provides 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit frost protection. Lettuce is a pretty cold hardy crop, along with spinach. Spinach is more cold hardy. But as soon as these nights start to get around 25 degrees or so, that's about the cutoff for when you could be harvesting your salad from outside. And that's the point where you'd want to be harvesting it from inside, like a greenhouse or a small hoop house structure.
And carrots, I tell you, I was trying to remember the year, but I had some carrots that stayed in the garden really, really late. And those turned out to be very tasty.
Yeah, we are kind of known for our winter carrots. We have a lot of customers that can't wait for us to have them back on the shelves. But the carrot itself can actually withstand pretty cold temperatures, I think at least 20 degrees or so. And the cool thing about them is as the temperature starts dropping, the carrot starts producing more sugar because sugar actually allows it to withstand the freezing temperatures better because it lowers the freezing point. So the side benefit of that is that we end up with a sweeter carrot. So we actually aim to leave our carrots outside so that they frost over a good number of times so that they produce a sweet winter carrot.
Oh, I've got to get over to your place to get some of those sweet winter carrots because I remember those as being so, so tasty. Really, really good.
So, they're very good.
Growing them indoors, not the carrots, but the salad mixes and that sort of thing, how difficult is it for the average homeowner to do that?
It's definitely a more challenging time of year to grow. Spring, early spring and late fall are not super challenging. Some of the considerations you want to have is you have decreased light, so you might want to space your plants out a little bit further from each other than they would be growing during the summer. You want to consider that they're going to be growing slower than they would during the middle of the year. So it's going to take longer from seeding to harvest than it normally would. And basically once daylight hours drop below 10 hours a day, which for us is around November 8th, the plants are going to grow extremely slowly at that point. So one thing that you can do is you can get, let's say you're growing some heads of lettuce, you get them basically to 90 to 100% maturity by November 8th, they can kind of just sit there then in your greenhouse until you're ready to harvest for a month, maybe even 2 months. And it's kind of like they're in cold storage. So you want to consider the spacing plants out a little bit more so you don't have disease issues. You want to water your plants less than you would during the summer because they're not growing as much. They're not using as much water. And if you introduce too much water to the growing environment, you're going to increase the risk of getting things like mildew because it's going to be a cold and humid environment. And then you just want to consider that they're going to take longer to grow. And of course, we're talking only about crops that are naturally cold hardy. So things like radishes and turnips and carrots, spinach. You can't use a hoop house to extend the season for all crops because some crops have much higher minimum temperature needs.
Dennis in Two Rivers has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, thanks. Since you mentioned keeping carrots out in the soil longer, I
I remember seeing some carrots with some red on them. So I guess that would mean there's some sugar, so they'd be safe to eat. Would that be accurate?
It was red on the carrot or on the greens?
It was on the carrot. Instead of it being orange, it was red. Or kind of like a light red.
Yeah.
And it was the whole carrot or just like a small section?
Well, it was a part above the ground.
Okay. I'm not super familiar with seeing that. I'm wondering if maybe it just got a little frost damaged. And was looking a little bit more translucent than normal. Like maybe the skin was a little bit frost damaged on the outside. But what I would generally recommend is if you pull them out of the ground and they're not all mushy and kind of soggy and whatnot, and they seem like a normal carrot, it's more than likely good to eat.
Yeah. You can give it a try, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You raise beets at all?
Yeah, we grow some beets.
What varieties do you like?
Well, we like growing the red varieties a little bit more because although we like the golden varieties, all the chipmunks on our property really like the golden varieties as well. So we have a tendency to find a little bite mark in every single beet down the row when we grow the golden varieties. But I think this year we were growing, Boldore, and I'd actually have to check back on which variety. I think we switched our variety recently, but, yeah, we grow golden and, red beets.
Okay. And actually Lori had emailed to ask how you select the varieties you grow every year. What do you look for?
With beets, we haven't played around with that many different varieties, but generally speaking, we're looking for something that is not a super long seed to harvest date, and something that just kind of works well with our soil type. So like I said, beets isn't something that we've experimented a ton with different varieties, but the ones that we have just work pretty well for us.
Yeah, and what about the other? I think Lori was asking about the other varieties of veggies that you grow. What do you look for?
Oh, yeah, definitely seed to harvest is something that we consider. Like with our carrots, we tend to grow a faster maturing variety. They're also a little bit of a smaller carrot, which we find that our customers like more out of a fresh carrot. For them to be not too large. Disease resistance is a big thing that we're looking for, being certified organic. There are a couple sprays that we could use to combat disease, but we rarely do that. And I find that just selecting the right genetics tends to yield better results than relying on some sort of organic spray. So for instance, in our greenhouses, we've moved recently to choosing more disease-resistant varieties of tomatoes during the summer. Tomatoes are very disease-prone, especially when grown in a humid greenhouse environment. So it's a balancing act between choosing the absolute best flavored, which we're always after the best tasting, the best textured produce that we can grow, but balancing that a little bit with natural disease resistance.
Yeah. Well, for tomatoes, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, oh, what kind of tomatoes do they grow? What are the varieties you tend to grow?
Yeah, we're growing. So one of our best growing cherry tomatoes is Sakura. That's something you could find at Johnny's Selected Seeds. That tomato we actually still have that tomato growing in one of our greenhouses, and it's still producing, and it's basically disease-free at this point, where almost every other tomato we grew ended up with some tomato leaf mold on it. We're also growing sun golds and black cherry tomatoes, and then we're growing French heritage varieties for our heirloom types. So they're basically heirloom quality tomatoes that are hybridized with a more modern tomato, so they have the texture and taste of an heirloom, and the disease resistant and production of more modern tomatoes. Those are Marbone, Margold, and Marnero.
Our guest today, Sean Kuhn of Vitruvian Farm, certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Sean Kuhn, our guest today from Vitruvian Farms, a certified organic vegetable and mushroom farm in McFarland. They have a grocery store there that you run that year round, don't you, Sean?
That's right.
Yeah, runs it year round, and those are all organically grown vegetables and mushrooms that he has. Andy wonders, do you run your CSA program kind of year round?
The CSA, we only run from about the beginning of June to like first week in October or so. So the CSA is kind of a limited season, but there's always the opportunity to come down to the farm store or check out our online store where you can get home delivery all year round.
And Grant emailed to ask if you overwinter parsnips. When they are overwintered, they are heavenly, according to Grant.
That is something that we have not tried. I am aware that you could do that. I'm assuming they get sweeter than normal, but that's not something we're currently doing.
Grace in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I was wondering about the, I'm not sure how to say it, it's reishi or reishi mushroom that I hear has a lot of medicinal purposes.
Reishi?
Yep. Yeah, reishi. Honestly, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it either, so no worries there. that's not really a culinary mushroom. I don't think it's very edible in that sense. Mostly people use it to make tea. Or they grind it up to encapsulate it. They grind it up to make a powder to encapsulate it. But I do believe reishi is pretty good for boosting your immune system. And then there are supposed longevity promoting aspects to some of the compounds that they're finding in that mushroom as well. If people are interested in learning more about some of those beneficial compounds, like I said earlier, I'd recommend doing a Google search for Paul Stamets.
Stamets, how's that last name spelled?
S-T-A-T-E-M-S. Sorry.
S-A-T-M-E-S?
S-T-A-T-E-S.
Ah.
Something
okay.
like that.
All right, got it. Let's see. Caller wondered if you've tried the Badger Flame Beets from the UW.
We have not tried growing those. I have heard about them, but we have not planted those yet.
They're really beautiful. When you pull them out of the ground, man, they're pretty. How did the crops do this year for you?
I think overall it was a pretty good growing year. It had its nuances like any other year. Spring was really great for us this year. It seemed like spring just kind of went on for a long time, in the sense that, you know, we had really nice low 70 temperatures for a while. We didn't get too much rain, which is something that's always difficult when you're growing food outside. You can't control how much rain you're getting, but you can control how much irrigation you're putting on the fields. We had a very interesting kind of early cold snap. That was a bit surprising there. I think that was around the beginning of September or so, where temperatures dropped abnormally cold. I think it was like the seventh coldest for that time of year in our area in over 100 years. So some of our outdoor crops were a bit shocked by that. I don't think the basil liked that. but I would say overall it was a very good growing year.
Do you grow garlic?
We grow garlic, yes.
We talked about growing garlic on the show a few weeks back, and we were going to talk about growing garlic indoors, and I never got around to it. Do you grow them in garlic indoors? And I think you could, I mean, if you can find some garlic for growing, you could do it indoors.
Yeah, I've never really heard of people growing it indoors. We grow ours outside. We actually planted our garlic about 3 weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, I think. But you plant the cloves in the fall and cover them with some straw, and they pop right up in springtime. So that's something we've never explored growing inside.
Yeah, somebody else was telling me you need about 6 to 8 hours of bright sunlight if you're doing it indoors, and maybe a south or east facing window, and moist soil, but not soggy. But then you can harvest the greens as they come up, or you could just let them go 10 months and harvest the bulb.
Sure. Yeah. Get some green garlic.
So what's the future look like at Vitruvian Farms?
Right now, we've got a pretty exciting project that we're hoping is going to start this next spring. We are hoping to build out a commercial kitchen in our new building, and that kitchen would allow us to start producing value-added goods. So right now in our store, we're selling all of our fresh produce and value-added goods from other producers and makers in the area. This kitchen would allow us to start actually producing our own branded value-added products, which would be really great because it could help decrease waste from food produced on the farm. If we produce a bumper crop of something, we can go ahead and make a product with it that we'll store. And then the hope is that that kitchen space can evolve to offer food service for events that we hold on the farm. So we're trying to... we're basically trying to offer more agritourism opportunities for people in the area. We want to offer a space where people could come out and enjoy a meal and a drink and connect with the land, connect with the farmers that are growing their food, and basically help educate people on the importance of local-based agriculture.
That is very exciting. And we can learn more about that on your website, I'm sure.
We, as long as everything keeps going the right direction, we should be making some announcements about it in the next couple months.
Very, very cool. One final question. Deb in Edgerton, she commonly used sliced up fresh button or cremini mushrooms not cooked in her salad. Is there a risk of toxins eating it this way?
Yeah, according to Paul Stamets, there is, and that's kind of a common thing that most people, I grew up eating raw button mushrooms as well. The recommendations that I've heard from people much smarter than myself is, including button mushrooms, always cook them. Don't eat them raw.
Okay. On that note, it's been a real pleasure once again talking with you, Sean. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to another visit down the road. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Sean Kuhn of Vitruvian Farms. You can go on his, just type in Vitruvian Farms and the site's going to pop up. Great to have him with us. And of course, great to have you listening in today. And a big thanks to our team who produces this show every day, pretty much every day, certainly every day of the week. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, part of the crew, executive producer Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller, and I want to thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.